This is the Medicast, July 28th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast. This is episode 128, and I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We've had a lot going on, as always, and I'm looking forward to getting some great information here for you, both news, commentary, and tips and meds this week. If you're a brand new listener to the show, I want to urge you to head over and check out the show notes with links to everything that we talk about in the episodes, as well as links to past episodes, and you can check out other episodes there in the blog, in the podcast category. You'll find the links to those individual show blogs over at medicast.com, where I have listings for all the shows in the Medicast network, and you can also sign up for the show notes newsletter. The show notes newsletter for each of those programs is a great way to get all of those links sent directly to your email address. Also, it's a great way to automatically be signed up for any giveaways we have here on the show, and a great way to get product savings, discounts, and other things all sent to you via the show notes newsletters. So don't hesitate, head over there and sign up right away for those. If you'd like to take it a step further, you can always join the Medicast forums over at forums.medicast.com. You'll find the Medicast forums a great resource for you to ask your questions and get answers from other members of the Medicast community. There's so many of you now, it's really hard for me to respond to everyone, although I'm still able to do it. But you might get a quicker response if you put your question up over in the forums. Also, you can get good answers from the providers in the forums, and you can provide your answers as well. We all see different things. We all come from different backgrounds, and it's a great way for everybody to share information over at the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. I got some great emails in from our friends down under. First off, an email I got from Irk. Irk is the host of the Irk Pod podcast, and he's actually been on the show talking about emergency services in New South Wales, Australia, talking a little bit about that. He's an emergency dispatcher for his local volunteer fire service, and Irk sent me an email with a link to a story from Australia looking at the costs involved with a recent ambulance call that was a hoax, and the response involved with that call and exactly what those costs were in ambulance and fire service costs. And Irk, I want to thank you very much for that link and article, and I'll be talking about that as the first item in the news coming up here very soon. I also want to thank our good friend Tim Pruin. He's a burn nurse out of the same region of Australia, New South Wales, near Sydney. And Tim sent me an article as well this week looking at the response issues and problems experienced by a hospital in Australia when their backup generators didn't work, and something to think about when you have issues of a similar type. So Tim, thank you for sending that in as well. Tim's a frequent guest on Irk's podcast, so you can check out the podcast, irkpod.com, E-R-K-pod.com, and you can listen to that. Now, it's not specifically an emergency services podcast, although because of their general experience, they talk about some of those issues. It's much more eclectic than that, but definitely a fun listen, and I think you'll enjoy listening to Irk's podcast. Check it out. Next up, I'd like to offer an apology to an individual. I misreferenced a concept that I talked about in a recent video release over at the Medicast Extra, and I also posted a shortened version of that video over on YouTube, a couple of other online video sites, including paramedictv.com, so you can check out that pediatric assessment triangle video if you'd like. But in that, I talked about the concept of sick, not sick. And I first heard this concept in the PEP class, the Pediatric Education for Pre-Hospital Providers class, where you do this pediatric assessment triangle, rapid assessment approach from across the room, and using the pediatric assessment triangle, determine if the child is sick or not sick. I was unaware, however, that this was a concept from an earlier publication, a book by Mike Helbach, who is a paramedic and instructor in Washington State, I believe, in the Northwest, at least in the United States. And Mike was sending me a comment basically saying, you know, you didn't reference me. I wish you would have. And I want to apologize. I try very hard to make sure that I'm referencing authoritative resources, that I'm providing proper references for anything that I find and discuss so that you know where I got the information from and I'm not plagiarizing anything. And I want to apologize publicly here to Mike and to his publisher. I did reference the PEP site, and I did reference the American Academy of Pediatrics site, as well as my Maryland protocols in that video at the very end. And I provided links to all of that, but apparently, because I was not aware that sick, not sick was a concept from somewhere else, I didn't link back to Mike. So I've put out a comment to Mike. I sent him an email back basically apologizing and offering to interview him here on the show and talk with him about sick, not sick, and talk about that rapid assessment approach and plug his book a little bit. And I will also be putting up a blog post about rapid assessment and using that book and linking it there as well, trying to build a little bit of sales for him. So you look for that in the coming week or so. But I want to apologize to Mike publicly here, and hopefully he'll come on the show and share his comments and thoughts with you, the listeners, on rapid assessment. And if you guys know Mike, I know I have listeners all over the country. Maybe you are aware of Mike and know about Mike. Please let him know that you heard this apology and let him know that I'd love to hear back from him and get him here on the show as a guest. So enough about that, but anytime you catch me in a mistake, folks, please send me an email and make me correct myself. That's the least I can do to make sure that we keep everything on the up and up here on the MedicCast. I got an email also from a listener by the name of Jen. Jen was asking me about the different journals or magazines for EMS that I look at, and did I have a preference between them, and what I might recommend for her. And I know I recently put up a post here and over at EMS Live about the different medical podcasts that I listen to, but what about the reading material that I find, whether it's online or not? Well, I think, Jen, the best solution for you is there's only two EMS journals out there really here in the United States, Emergency Medical Services and the Journal for Emergency Medical Services. So that's GEMS and EMS and GEMS, respectively. And you can find more about subscribing to those over at emsresponder.com for the Emergency Medical Services and over at GEMS, GEMS.com. And you can subscribe there. I'll have a link in the show notes to some of this, or perhaps maybe I'll just do a blog post on some of the reading that I do, some of the books and articles and magazines that I subscribe to or have purchased, because I think that it's important that we provide these resources and share them around. So Jen, thank you for your email, and I will get some more information out on the blog in the next week or so to let you know about that. We'll lead off the news tonight with a story from our friend Irk at the Irk Pod Podcast. Irk sent up a news article from his region looking at the cost associated with the response of units to a reported motor vehicle accident rollover on a mountainside with 8 persons on board that turned out to be a hoax. And in spite of the fact that 3 ambulances were sent and 2 helicopter transport units were sent, that it turned out to not, in fact, be an actual call. The unit searched the region and drove up and down the stretch of highway that had been reported as the location of the accident until the dispatch center attempted to recontact the caller and was unable to reach them. A supervisor then listened to the recorded initial call and believed that it was a similar voice or the same voice as a prior hoax call that had been received in the past. This is something that is of concern, of course, because we roll out the door on emergencies and we need to make sure we arrive there safely and arrive home safely. And every time we do get out on the roads and are driving in emergency response, there is an additional risk associated with that. But it points out something to me that we all need to keep in mind, I think firmly in mind. And that is that this is not our emergency. This is someone else's emergency. And the most important thing for us personally is to make sure we arrive safely to perform the care needed and that we return home safely at the end of the shift. And in order to do that, we need to make sure we're operating safely, no matter how serious the call, no matter how much of an emergency there is. We don't do anybody any good if we don't arrive safely. And how much more terrible it would have been in the case of this article that IRC sent up our way if one of those ambulances had been involved in an accident or one of those air transport units, those helicopters, had crashed en route to the scene and the persons on board had died or been severely injured. This is something we need to keep in mind, and not saying we're not going to respond to the calls that come in, but certainly we should keep in mind that it's not our emergency and to respond safely, get there safely, perform our duties safely, and get home safely. So I want to thank IRC for sending that article up. And of course, guess what? I've got another article from a friend down under next. We also got an article link in from our friend Tim in that same area. Tim is a friend of IRC's and a friend of ours, and Tim sent a link up about a hospital there that had experienced a blackout and then had further issues when their backup generators failed to work properly. And it calls to mind some things that we need to think about in the emergency response sector, not because we work in hospital facilities and would need to be aware of this, but because we are emergency responders and healthcare providers as well. And it's important that our stations remain either on the grid or at least supplied with enough electricity to do the jobs we need to do. So how often are your backup generators tested? Is it something that's part of your routine checks, either weekly or monthly, where the generators are fired up, run through their paces? How often are they having routine maintenance performed? If you don't have generators, is there enough carrier juice to reach from your units to the nearest repeater tower? These are things you need to be aware of. Also, because facilities need power, what facilities are in your first due region that might need some follow-up in the event of a long-term power outage where they might need to be checked in on? Local nursing homes? Also, especially here in the U.S., we see increasingly private residences that have been transformed into assisted living homes for multiple patients. How about these facilities? Are they equipped with any kind of backup power? And if they do have a backup generator, what kind of time frame are they looking at being able to subsist before they need to refuel or relocate? Something to think about as you're driving around your region. If you go to one of these assisted living facilities, ask the person in charge, hey, do you have an emergency response plan? Would you like us to put somebody in touch with you so that we can add you to our emergency response plan so that we can check in on you in the event of a widespread disaster? So as you're driving around your region to and from other emergencies and you see a business that might need some additional support in an emergency situation like a disaster, a natural disaster, power outage, think about and jot down some ideas on whether they need to be contacted or not. Now, this maybe falls to the local emergency operations center, but it doesn't hurt for us to at least be aware of their location and ask what the plan is in the event of a widespread emergency, because we're going to be the ones that are going to be assisting with implementing that plan. We're going to be the ones that are going to be called upon to assist with evacuations and relocations of facilities with elderly persons involved. What kind of facilities are nearby that you can even transport them to? These are things that need to be part of your planning process as well as the overall local or county planning process or state planning process, depending on how your region planning process is developed. But something to keep in mind and something you should at least be a little bit aware of. So let's bring this disaster preparedness thing back home again and think about what's going on here in the States. I found a great article looking at a program in parts of rural New York, Rensselaer County to be specific, where there are going to be additional rescuers available to provide medical care before ambulances arrive. And that is the local Rensselaer County Sheriff's Department. The sheriff's deputies that will be on the road are all now licensed medical EMTs and will have a kit in the back of their units that will allow them to provide initial medical care until ambulances and other EMS responders arrive. And, you know, this is something that we need to keep in mind as we plan for needed response or additional assistance. And also, when we have situations where we need to ask bystanders or other responders on scene for help with our taking care of our patients, whether it's even something as simple as preparing an IV bag, spiking a bag and getting the line bled out and ready to go for administering IV fluids to a patient. How many of us have sat down as ALS providers and taught the BLS providers with whom we work how to do this very simple task? This is something that in situations like this, you should be thinking about the other responders in your region. Maybe offer a joint training class where they get to come in and see some of the toys you carry, learn where things are kept on your units, and understand and learn how to do things like set up IV fluids for you to use on a patient, or where you keep certain things like suction and portable suction units on your ambulances so that you can send them out to grab it for you. Again, this is something you just think about because it's not something you're going to be having time to mess with when you do need it. And I don't expect this to be something that's necessary very frequently, but if you need it once a year and you've prepared for it, it's going to be a whole lot easier when you just look over your shoulder, see one of those deputies that you've done a joint training with and say, hey, do you know where the portable suction is? Can you go grab it for me? Or, hey, I need an IV bag set up in the back of the ambulance when we get back out there with the patient. Those kind of things can save you some time and effort en route to the hospital so that you can move on to providing the next step in patient care. And it also provides a team effort and will go a long way towards making sure that we all operate on the same team and get along really well together. And I think that's just as important. Finally, I guess this has become the disaster news day for Medicast here, and I'm wondering if our friend Rick Rosati over at the Mitigation Journal podcast has taken a look at this particular article. But while it seems that the federal government has still got their thumbs somewhere as far as disaster response in many respects, a lot of state agencies seem to be stepping up to the plate and raising the bar on where we should be as far as preparedness goes. An article I found coming out of Texas with the recent approach of Hurricane Dolly there last week, there was a story about an East Texas medical center sending 6 ambulances from their region down to the area expected to be hit by the hurricane in an effort to be prepared to provide response immediately after the disaster occurs. And I think this is something that was one of the lessons learned as Katrina hit, although the devastation there was so widespread, it would have been difficult to put any type of formed response online very quickly. In this situation, in a milder storm where it is not as likely to have a serious long-term effect, it was good to see still that they went down there and were ready to provide care. One of the quotes I saw really brought this home to me. We've been working with the statewide disaster preparedness committee for the last 2.5 years, so we as a state are better prepared to respond to statewide disasters, whether it's hurricanes, tornadoes, or chemical warfare. It's all an effort to serve the state of Texas and to be better prepared. And I think this is something that we all should be thinking about. And one of the things I really love about the emergency services community in general, when problems happen that aren't part of our own backyard, we are ready to jump in and go wherever the trouble is and lend a hand. We saw that with Katrina, with EMTs, paramedics, and other responders from all over the country and indeed the world traveling to that region to assist and provide care until local emergency services were able to begin responding on their own. And that is something that I think is characteristic of responders worldwide. And we see it all the time. When there's a disaster in a region, a lot of international animosities, local problems get put aside in most cases, not all, but most cases, and help is offered and brought in rapidly to provide assistance. We saw that with the tsunami that struck Indonesia a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, recently we saw that when aid is refused or delayed by a local government for political reasons, that it is devastating to that region's residents. But even though we were not sure if they would accept our assistance, many, many countries immediately offered aid and moved assistance into place to be mobilized to send to that region. And so I think it's something that we need to just kind of be proud of as emergency responders worldwide, that we drop what we're doing and help out each other, help out other communities, because that's what we do. We're about lending a hand and helping people out. And I just want to say that I'm proud to be a member of this community. I'm proud to help provide some small level of service to that community with the Medicast and the other efforts that I've put together here. And this community effort is just indicative of the worldwide community that is emergency response. And you can see that just in how the news shook out today. The news, I got two links from the news from Australia, and they were relevant to what we do. They were relevant to what I would say anybody does in any part of the world, because we all share a common thread in the fact that we want to go out, we want to provide care, we want to provide quality and competent care and the best possible care we can. So I just want to say kudos to what it appears Texas has done in their emergency response planning efforts. And I hope that this is indicative of what other states in the country are doing to prepare for their own emergency widespread disaster response plans. For the tip of the week this week, I thought I would pick up where I left off last week and expand a little bit on the EMS pharmacology concepts that I discussed or started to discuss last week. And last week, of course, we covered routes of administration. So this week, I thought I would add on to that and talk a little bit about some of the underlying concepts surrounding EMS pharmacology. Now, for those of you that are members over at the Medicast Extra, you've gotten some of this information in the recent video update and also the student handout PDFs that I included recently over at the Medicast Extra site. But I am also including an audio version here, and of course you'll get this update as well. First off, there are two underlying concepts having to do with EMS pharmacology that we really need to have a good handle on. Those two concepts are the concepts of pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. Now, this is one of those, two of those terms, actually, that you sit there and you scratch your head. Which one's which? What do they mean? How do I tell them apart? Well, I'm going to give you some easy ways to do that here. First off, pharmacokinetics. Let's start with that one. Kinetics, think kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is the energy of motion, okay? When you have, you know, the old physics lesson from high school, you have a ball sitting at the top of a hill balanced there, it has potential energy. That energy is not doing anything, it's potential energy. When you push the ball one way or the other on the hilltop, it begins to roll down the hill, and it converts that potential energy into kinetic energy, the energy of motion. So, using that concept of the ball rolling down the hill in motion, we can now say pharmacokinetics is the movement of medications, motion of medications throughout the body. And there are some key points of pharmacokinetics that we can look at. They include understanding how different tissues affect the routes of administration and how those tissues absorb the medication. So it's movement of the medication into the body through the route of administration, absorbed into the tissue, and then sent back out into the circulatory system where it is distributed, the distribution network around the body, to the target tissue. Once it reaches the target tissue, it is, in many cases, transformed in some way. So biotransformation takes place. Sometimes that biotransformation takes place upon absorption. Sometimes biotransformation also can refer to the breaking down of the active form of the medication at the other end, and then elimination of it. So these concepts all have to do with pharmacokinetics, the medications in motion. So let's start and look at those four parts of pharmacokinetics. Absorption involves the route of administration, understanding concepts surrounding the absorbing tissue's characteristics, including things like vascularity, the density of the tissue, proximity of that absorbing tissue to the target location, the tissue that you want to act on, and also the relationship of that target tissue to the circulatory system. These are all parts of the absorption process and are going to affect the absorption of the medication, and that's part of pharmacokinetics. Next is distribution, and distribution in most cases in the body has to do with absorption into the circulatory system. Once in the circulatory system, the medications or the transformed medication are transported around the body to the target tissues, and then byproducts or metabolized medications are then transported also out of the body to the points where they are eliminated. So distribution encompasses a lot of these things. Distribution also has to do with the movement of the medication across important membranes into the cells. For instance, if you administer insulin or you administer D50 dextrose to a patient, that is absorbed into the body, into the bloodstream by way of an injection. The injection gets the medication either into a tissue or into the bloodstream directly, and then it travels to the cells where the glucose is ready to be absorbed, right? Well, it can't be absorbed if there's no insulin present. So that movement across the cell membrane is part of this distribution process as well. And then, of course, the distribution of the products of elimination back to the parts of the body where they will be eliminated. Next is biotransformation. Biotransformation is another important part of the pharmacokinetics process. It has to do with the transformation of a drug either during absorption or during distribution into an active medication. Many meds are stored in an inactive form, and they are transformed upon reaching the body into an active form that can be used by a target tissue. Biotransformation also refers to the breaking down of medications into their metabolites, into their byproducts, where they are sent out and ready for elimination. This is something also that can be important because biotransformation is also a process by which side effects occur, because some of these byproducts are the byproducts that cause side effects. It might be things like increased acidosis in a patient because of certain byproducts. It may be other side effects that are occurring because of the byproducts having an effect on the organs of elimination. So again, biotransformation is something to keep in mind and understand. Finally, elimination. How is a drug removed from the body? This is an important part of the process because if you can't get the drug out of the body once it's been administered, then that drug will build up. So if you ordinarily are giving a drug to a patient every 15 minutes, if they are unable to adequately metabolize and get ready to eliminate that medication, then you're going to be increasing the amount of available drug in their body because they are not eliminating it as fast as you suspect that they will. This is important to understand in patients that are elderly because they have a decreased metabolism and decreased functionality of many of their organ systems. Also, any patient with problems like kidney failure, problems like liver failure, or some kind of GI block, depending on the route of elimination of a given medication, you could be increasing their potential dose in their system if they are unable to effectively eliminate that med, or increasing the number of toxic byproducts in their system. So again, it's something to keep in mind that patients with underlying pathology may need a lesser dose because they are unable to effectively eliminate the drug. And Elimination, forms of elimination include eliminating drugs in the urine via the kidneys, via the GI tract, as through the liver in bile, or in through the intestines in feces. Also, elimination through exhaled gases in the airways, and also excretion through the skin or mucous membranes and other parts of the body. Sometimes medications are eliminated through the excretory process when they excrete through things like their sweat glands. Again, something to keep in mind, always how the drug is going to be eliminated. So we've looked at pharmacokinetics, how the drugs move through the body, how they're changed into an active medication, and then how they are moved out of the body. And this is, again, pharmacokinetics, medications on the move. What about pharmacodynamics? Well, pharmacodynamics, I like to think of dynamic action, okay? When something is dynamic, it's very active, it's very agitated. Someone's a very dynamic speaker. I like to think that I am in some ways, that a dynamic speaker is somebody who speaks with their arms, lots of action, lots of activity, okay? So this means that pharmacodynamics is medications in action. This means this is how they're acting in the way we expect them to, their mechanism of action. How are they working on the body when they reach a target tissue? And this is understanding things like some key concepts like the binding sites, how proteins work in certain membranes, also understanding how different things either are encouraging a process to occur or blocking a process from occurring. And this is all part of what is referred to in pharmacodynamics. So what are we looking at here? Well, we're first off talking about binding sites. Binding sites for some medications include protein sites. And I like to think about this like a lock and a key or a puzzle piece in a jigsaw puzzle. You know, only a certain key is going to fit in that lock and make it turn. Only a certain puzzle piece is going to fit into the picture and look like the rest of the picture. So we have some medications that are going to fit into the picture or fit into the lock and make it work. They're going to make the picture complete, or they're going to turn the lock and activate something to occur. And these are called the agonists. So you have things like sympathetic nervous system agonists, like epinephrine. Epinephrine causes the sympathetic nervous system to become more effective. It increases the response of the heart rate and the contractility. It increases peripheral vasoconstriction so that the blood pressure increases. It dilates the small airways so that more oxygen can be brought in. These are all parts of the sympathetic nervous system process, and epinephrine actually increases that response. It's a sympathetic agonist. There are also puzzle pieces and keys that, while they fit, do not cause this action to occur. Picture a puzzle that's a picture, and you fit a puzzle piece in that's a blank white piece. It fits into the puzzle, but it's blank and white. This is blocking. You can't put another puzzle piece in there. Or a lock, a key that fits into a lock but won't turn. This is blocking. You can't put another key in there until you get that other key out. These are the blockers. Think beta blockers. We talk about beta blockers all the time. Beta blockers are medications that block the effects, the beta effects of the sympathetic nervous system. When you take this medication, you will stop epinephrine from binding to those sites and stop norepinephrine from binding to those sites, and you block the sympathetic nervous system response. And so you have a decreased blood pressure, a decreased heart rate, because you cannot increase those effectively through the sympathetic nervous system response because beta blockers are taking up those binding sites. So it's important to understand some of those concepts. In addition to understanding the concepts of binding sites and the understanding the concepts of agonists and antagonists, or the blockers, we also need to understand a little bit about how dosing works. And there are two key concepts to understand about dosing. First of all, there is the concept of the therapeutic threshold and the therapeutic index. Two things, again, sounds a little bit similar. Let's think about it. Therapeutic threshold has to do with your dose, and we're going to look at the word threshold here. Threshold, think about the threshold of your door. If you have steps up into your house and the threshold's there, if you can't get across the threshold of your front door, you can't get into the house, right? So So that's a minimum level. If you can't get across that threshold level, you can't get in. So therapeutic threshold is the minimum dose required to have a desired effect. Very simple, okay? The next concept is therapeutic index. And this is an index, think of a range of doses. The therapeutic threshold is the bottom range, the minimum range, and you can probably think where I'm going with this. Therapeutic index refers to the difference between the therapeutic threshold and the level at which you have toxic effects. In other words, the level at which you've given an overdose to the patient. And some medications have a very narrow therapeutic index where the difference between giving them the right amount and an overdose is very thin. And also medications that have a very wide therapeutic index. You can give them medication. Once you get over that therapeutic threshold, you've got a long way in dose to get before you reach the point where it's toxic. And this is not common for every person. In other words, it's not going to be the same. Again, different pathologies, whether they can eliminate the medication effectively. Goes back to pharmacokinetics and the concepts of absorption, distribution, and elimination. If you cannot get rid of the medication effectively, then the dosing range could be narrowed because they're not going to get rid of previous doses as fast. So again, you need to be aware of these concepts. So that's a quick look at some very basic concepts underlying pharmacology in general, and I've related them to EMS pharmacology. But again, remember, pharmacokinetics, meds on the move. Pharmacodynamics, meds in action. And you'll have a good handle on what those two things mean. And you can start applying them to the medications that are in your toolkit as you learn whether you're an EMTB or an EMTP or EMTI with ALS medications, you can get a better handle on understanding how these medications work once they're inside the body. For the tip of the week this week, let's look at the advanced life support uses of epinephrine. We've looked at the BLS use of the auto-injector in the past, but let's talk a little bit about ALS epinephrine administration. First of all, you want to follow your own protocols, your own guidelines for this. I'll be looking at some of the guidelines that under which I operate, but you should always double-check your own protocols and your own facility guidelines for administration of any medication and understand and operate under those rules, of course. The pharmacology of epinephrine is that the epinephrine is a sympathetic agonist. It activates the sympathetic nervous system. It increases the response of the sympathetic nervous system, causing responses like systemic vascular resistance, that peripheral vascular constriction, also systemic increases in arterial pressure, heart rate increases, both a chronotropic, a rate increase, and a contractility increase, the inotropic response. Also, it will increase myocardial oxygen demands and will increase the heart's automaticity factor. And this is one of the reasons we administer it in cases of cardiac arrest, to try to increase the myocardial response and ability to respond to its electrical impulses. Along with the increased automaticity of the heart, there is increased conduction of impulses through the AV node as a result of epinephrine administration. And epinephrine also has the similar beta 2 effects you see in beta 2 agonists, and these are the expansion and dilation of the smooth muscles surrounding the bronchial tree and allowing opening of the air passages, as in situations of severe asthma or anaphylactic response. Pharmacokinetics of epinephrine when administered IV, very rapid onset of action in the IV route, rapidly absorbed by the body, also rapidly broken down by the body, primarily by the liver. If you're administering it subcutaneously, it is a slower absorption due to the fact that it causes local vasoconstriction and it's absorbed slowly. You can increase the rate of absorption in a sub-Q injection or an IM injection by massaging around the injection site to increase the absorption rate. Also, you can apply this via inhalation route by applying it via a nebulizer directly to the respiratory tract, and it will have the vasoconstrictor properties similar in reducing the edema in the mucosal and submucosal linings of the respiratory tract, and it can have direct bronchodilator effects in the airway as well when absorbed via that route. So epinephrine is kind of like a go-to product for severe emergencies when needed and can be administered in a variety of different routes. It's indicated in cases of cardiac arrest or moderate to severe allergic reaction or anaphylaxis. It may also be indicated in cases of severe asthma and in patients that are having severe respiratory stridor, those young patients that have croup or perhaps even epiglottitis, where you want to decrease the edema in the airway. It can have those effects as well. It is not indicated in patients that have hypertension, pre-existing arrhythmias or tachyarrhythmias, and these patients, we would of course increase their heart rate, and we don't want to do that. So you need to use carefully in patients that have a known history of things like SVT or in patients that already are being treated for hypertension. In fact, any cardiac patient, if they're not in cardiac arrest, we should be using caution when using epinephrine in these patients. Also, it should be used with extreme caution in patients who may be pregnant. So if you have a female patient and you're administering this medication to them, you should ask them if they are pregnant as part of your history taking so that you can get appropriate indications when administering this medication and appropriate direction if needed from medical control if the patient is indeed pregnant. The adverse effects most commonly seen include, as I said already, increased heart rate and tachyarrhythmias. So you may see those changes in the heart rate that are negative. They could be progressing into a supraventricular tachycardia. They may progress into even a ventricular tachycardia with the administration of epinephrine. So it's important to monitor that. Because of the peripheral vasoconstriction, we're going to see an increase in their blood pressure. We also may find that this induces labor in pregnant women, and we want to make sure that that's monitored carefully. Patients are also going to start exhibiting some anxiety and nervousness as the administration of this medication progresses. Also, they may complain of headache. They may also have a decreased level of consciousness, and they may have a rebound edema effect 20 to 30 minutes after administration in patients that get it via the inhalation route. So initially, you get the deflation of the inflammatory response. You get to constrict the mucosal linings. However, as the effects of the epinephrine wear off, you can have an increased response back into the inflammatory system, and the mucosal linings can swell back up beyond where they were before. So epinephrine, when used in this situation, you need to be prepared for that response as well. You want to make sure when administering this medication that you do not administer it with sodium bicarb in the same IV line, because it will inactivate the epinephrine. Also, you will find that there will be a great increase in myocardial oxygen demand. So again, be very careful in the use of this with cardiac patients with existing cardiac issues, because you're going to increase the workload on the heart. Also, remember that epinephrine comes in two different dose ranges, and it's preformulated either 1 to 1,000 or 1 to 10,000, and that is 1 milligram in 1 milliliter of fluid or 1 milligram diluted in 10 milliliters of fluid. And it's important to make sure you understand the distinction of this and you're careful when drawing up and measuring your medications. And remember that the increased dose is at a higher concentration. You're going to be giving 1 to 1,000. You do not usually ever want to use this via the IV route. In rare cases, perhaps in patients who are pulseless, but generally IV 1 to 10,000 is the preferred route for the diluted form of the drug. Dosage and indications include in cardiac arrest, you want to administer 1 milligram, 1 to 10,000 IV push every 3 to 5 minutes, and this is straight out of the general ACLS protocols. If you administer this medication via the ET tube route, the dose would be 2 to 2.5 times the IV dose, and you would want to dilute the 1 to 1,000 solution in 10 mLs of lactated ringers or normal saline before putting it down the tube if that's the only formulation you had on hand. In pediatric patients, you would want to, in cases of cardiac arrest, administer the dose at a range of 0.01 milligrams per kilogram, that's 0.01 milligrams per kilogram, and you would want to use that in the 1 to 10,000 range, and that would be IVIO, also repeated every 3 to 5 minutes, and again, the ET tube dose of 1 to 1,000 would be 0.1 milligrams per kilogram diluted in 5 mLs of lactated ringers or normal saline, and again, repeated every 3 to 5 minutes. I'm not a big fan of ET administration. It seems like you just get it frothing back up the tube. I don't think that's a very effective administration form, and with the use of intraosseous products like the EZ-IO or other IO drills and products out there, we really don't need to be using the ET route as much as we had in the past when we couldn't get easy IV access to these patients. Again, you want to also use in cases of bradycardia, and it would not necessarily be indicated in adult patients. However, in pediatric patients, in place of using atropine, because atropine is not always effective in pediatric patients, you would administer the dose, the same dose range, 0.01 milligrams per kilogram of the 1 to 10,000 IV or IO, and it can also be administered via the ET tube in the same doses as before. For allergic reaction, use in anaphylactic shock patients, you would want to use the adult dose of 1 to 1,000, and it would be 0.01 milligrams per kilogram IM with a maximum single dose, and this is out of the Maryland protocol, maximum single dose of 0.5 milligrams. And in the pediatric dose range, it's the same dose, 0.01 milligrams per kilogram, again, to a maximum single dose of 0.5 milligrams per milligrams total in that single dose. You would also want to be aware of use in the inhalation route via the nebulizer, and in pediatric patients who have suspected croup and severe respiratory or onset of moderate to severe respiratory distress, you want to administer 2.5 mLs of Epi 1 to 1,000 via a nebulizer, and then be prepared to administer further doses with medical controls approval as necessary. Now, it's important that you understand the side effects of epinephrine. This is a medication that has widespread effects on the body, and it's something you should review periodically so that you understand how this works in the particular field in which you're working, and also be prepared to deal with side effects and adverse effects as necessary. It's obviously, in cases of use of epinephrine, it's an emergency situation because of the very nature of the drug, but there doesn't mean we shouldn't be prepared to take care of taking care of patient side effects. And that may be controlling or helping to calm patients who become anxious because of the administration of this medication if they're conscious, or in the cases of cardiac arrest patients or cardiac patients that once we bring them back from cardiac arrest with the administration of this drug, we may need to be prepared to deal with tachyarrhythmias as the patient's heart rate returns. We need to be prepared to deal with the increased oxygen demands on the heart from this particular med. So that's a look at the ALS uses of epinephrine and some of the indications and pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of the drug. You should always, as I said earlier, refer to your own protocols, because there is some differences in opinion among medical directors on the dose ranges, and it's important that you use this for general purposes only and make sure you refer to your own protocols and guidelines first. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show and for heading over and checking out the MedicCast website at MedicCast.com, because I know you're all going to head over there and check out the links for this week's episode. And of course, I want you to do that. That's why I put them up there. I also want to remind you that you can always get in touch with me directly, either by leaving a comment over at medicast.com and on the Medicast blog. You can also get in touch with me via email by sending me an email to podmedic@mac.com, and I will get back to you. You can also get in touch with me on the voicemail line, and that is 941-306-3342, and that's 941-30-MEDIC. So if you're driving down the road listening to the show and you'd like to make a comment right away and you've got hands-free calling available because we want to be safe about this, you can go ahead and call in directly. When you do so, leave me a quick statement of your email at the very end. I'll clip it off, but that way if I have any questions or need clarification, I can go ahead and get in touch with you and get that taken care of as well. So again, use the voicemail line. We love to hear from the listeners. Don't forget to check out the Medicast forums if you haven't already done so. Forums.medicast.com. There's been quite a few good additions to some of the posts over there and new questions being posed all the time. So you want to check that out. Also, I post up some of the short video segments. These are little video snippets of the longer video segments I use over at the Medicast Extra site. And they are not teasers. They are full segments in and of themselves, but they're just portions of some of the other videos that the Medicast Extra members get a handle on. And you can actually find those over on the Medicast forums page as well, because you can share video and photos as well. Free to register over there. Check it out and join the extended community over in the Medicast forums. And I think that's enough of me. It's been a little long today. We're actually pushing up on an hour. So I'm going to wrap up with some PodSafe music. This is Caitlin Smith. We've played her music here off and on for a long time here on the Medicast, one of our favorite PodSafe artists. And this is her song, Breathe Deep. If you like what you hear from Caitlin and you want to check out more, you can find more of her music on her MySpace page. It's Caitlin Smith, CaitlinSmith. Caitlin Smith. Or you can follow the link in the show notes. I also have a link for you to go directly to the iTunes store and purchase her music. If you like what you hear, you can certainly go ahead and do that as well. So that's it. Enough of me talking. Let's end up with Caitlin's great song. And I will leave you all, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. And remember, folks, until next time, scene safety, BSI.